Common Sense Conversations is a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. Independent, nonpartisan, facts, and common sense since 1995.
Hi, welcome again to Common Sense Conversation. I'm Ryan Alexander, and if you are listening, you know that Taxpayers for Common Sense is a nonpartisan budget watchdog where we look at fiscal policy, read appropriations bills, read tax bills, and, you know, generally have fun. If you have been in the world for the last couple of weeks and heard the radio or seen a newspaper, you know there's been a lot of drama in D.C., but there's a lot of stuff happening that isn't making the headlines and isn't making the front page. Those are the things we continue to watch. We're going to talk about a couple different things this week, and I have with me my Executive Vice President Steve Ellis and Vice President Autumn Haddam. Welcome, guys. So let's start with a nerdy issue and something you definitely haven't heard enough about, which is the biofuels tax credit. This is the largest subsidy at the moment that runs $3 billion a year. That's a lot of money. And the subsidies have been handed out for decades. We recently released a report on detailing just how much taxpayer-funded subsidies that the industry has enjoyed and doesn't need. Autumn can explain. The title of our exciting report is Biodiesel Bonanza. You can get it on our website, taxpayer.net. Autumn, want to talk a little more?
Sure. Thanks, Ryan. As Ryan just mentioned, last week we did release a new report that details billions of dollars in subsidies for the biodiesel industry. We found the largest of those subsidies, the biodiesel tax credit, cost taxpayers about $3 billion in 2017 and more than $12 billion in the last 10 years. Currently, that tax credit is expired, but there are active proposals in Congress to not only extend it, but to retroactively extend it, costing taxpayers up to $19 billion.
I'm going to stop you for a minute, just so we can back up and say some basic things about biofuels and biodiesel, just because, well, we think about these things all the time. We can talk about it a little. Steve or Autumn?
No,
corn,
I mean,
ethanol versus biodiesel versus...
I think that's a good point you should understand. So biodiesel is... Some of you have been familiar with it, but it's not the same as what we used to think. Biodiesel was always this small-scale fuel that was used from animal and vegetable waste, and instead now it's being mass-produced from soy, large-scale soy production. And so that's really this change of just not just being able to take animal or vegetable oil waste and sort of collect it and create this small-scale fuel, but this large major agricultural production is now happening to create this biodiesel fuel, which is then blended with gasoline or can be used independently. As you can imagine, now this large-scale production has different impacts than that small-scale production we've seen in the past, and these subsidies are a major driver of that. That's what we really detail in our report, causing huge impacts for taxpayers, consumers, and the environment then because of these virgin feedstocks. Primarily here it's soy, but you also can have feedstock coming from palm, and this displaces food production, increases habitat loss, water pollution, water treatment costs, public health impacts, lots of negative impacts now associated with this large-scale biodiesel production.
And Autumn, in the biodiesel bonanza report, didn't it document that you could look at the year that the tax credit was in place and they had a huge boost in production, and when it lapsed, it fell? Is that right?
That's right. And we do have a nice chart illustrating this, looking at the years that the tax credit was in place and how there was a spike in production, and the years where we had the lapse that there was a decrease of up to 10 million gallons in production. And really what you see from this analysis that we did is that the tax credit is the driver here, not consumers, and that it's about making money and padding profits and not really responding to market demands at all.
Which leads me to another of my favorite points to emphasize: the retroactive reauthorization of a tax credit. Either one of you want to kind of just talk through how that works and how insane it is?
Well, so tax credits and tax preferences are used to generally encourage behavior that wouldn't otherwise occur. And so that's generally what any subsidy is there for. But obviously, if you have a retroactive tax credit, well, then that activity has already happened. And so why would we be providing subsidies to then just line their pockets? Because they either did the activity or didn't do the activity. And yet we see that not just with this tax credit, but it's latched onto a whole package that what I would call the cockroaches of the Washington policy establishment, the tax extenders package that seems to get renewed every few years, tacked onto some large piece of legislation. And this includes things like the benefits for NASCAR track owners. This includes benefits for, we just had the Kentucky Derby, and how you can expense a racehorse in just 3 years, which notably the horses that race in the Triple Crown are three-year-olds. It also has a whole litany of tax credits and tax benefits.
Back to biodiesel.
Yes. So, and this is where this tax exemption package is where the biodiesel tax credit catches its ride as well. And right now it's the largest of those subsidies at more than $3 billion. So we are definitely watching as the tax expenditures process here develops. There are proposals introduced in the Senate. There is talk in the House committees. And so we are trying to actively educate folks on the costs here to taxpayers, consumers, and the environment with this extension. Already 7 times the biodiesel tax credit has been extended. And this, as Steve was discussing, is just a bad way for any of these tax credits to catch a ride. They don't get fully vetted. And they hide the costs of them by doing these one-year or short-term extensions. When you just do it, when you renew them or then retroactively renew them, the taxpayers' costs are there regardless of how you do it. And now you don't have to look at that whole cost at once. You hide it in these shorter term extensions.
And I think it's also worth noting that we just at the end of last Congress, we just enacted the largest tax legislation in 30 years, and it was a huge tax cut. And yet none of these, or very few of these, migrated into the actual tax bill. And if they were going to really rise to the merits, that's when they should have addressed it, rather than having this additional package that's going to cost taxpayers.
And my favorite fact about that, the day after the 2017 tax bill passed, Senator Hatch introduced reauthorization of tax extenders and renewal of tax extenders. So it wasn't like they didn't know it.
Right. The last thing I'll just say about biodiesel and why folks should check out our full report, the biodiesel bonanzas, because we go through all of the other layers of subsidies for the bio industry as well, and those cross government agencies like the USDA, the Department of Energy, Treasury, and more. And it talks about the benefits that biodiesel have in the renewable fuels standard right now as well. So take a look at our new report. It's all in there.
I would also say, if you want a slightly shorter thing to read, The Hill published an op-ed that talks about these issues on Friday. So if you go to thehill.com and search Ryan Alexander, you'll find it. But you can also just go to taxpayer.net. But before we leave the exciting world of biofuels, Autumn, I want to switch back to corn ethanol and talk about what EPA has been doing and explain how it fits into subsidies, since EPA is usually much more of a regulatory body.
Right. So there has been a lot going on in the world of biofuels these last several weeks, and the EPA is in the process of doing a rulemaking on the year-round sale of E15, which is gasoline blended with 15% ethanol, and most of us, the consumer blend that we see is E10, which is 10%. So this would be an increase of the percentage of corn ethanol in your gasoline. And of course, as we've been saying for years, there are real impacts to this increased corn ethanol production. There are huge subsidies associated with the corn production and corn ethanol, and then also impacts on food prices and consumers and land use being converted to grow corn. The reason that EPA is involved with this is it stems from the air quality concerns that from this higher blend of ethanol being sold. And we have concerns about that because there are obviously costs to taxpayers when you have increased impacts with air quality. But it's just, for us, our number one concern is just adding another layer of subsidies to corn ethanol and tying that into an already distorted marketplace because of the RFS. We joined with our colleagues at the National Taxpayers Union last week in submitting our comments and raising concerns about the cost impacts of this proposal at EPA, and really get into the details of how that analysis hasn't been done and the layers of subsidies that come along with a proposal like this. I mean, infrastructure needs to change when you have E15, and so you have blender pump subsidies that we gave our Golden Fleece Award just a few years back to then Secretary of Ag, Vilsack, and he was moving money around at USDA to give $100 million to blender pumps for this E15. So there's definitely going to be infrastructure subsidies and other impacts on the market if you start increasing the sale of E15. And there's also, we have a lot of colleagues in a coalition that we work with, who represent small engines and boaters and motorcyclists and other impacts, another impacted constituencies, because E15 is not compatible with these small engines. So you have all the costs associated with that, and as well as the environmental costs, as I mentioned earlier. So real impacts to this expansion of E15.
And I would also flag that, several years ago when they were arguing that this conversion, this use of corn for diverted to ethanol doesn't actually increase commodity prices. But then now part of the argument of doing E15 year round has been the commodity prices are damaged so much by the president's trade war and that this is trying to boost crop prices. So years ago they said it had no impact. Now they're saying we need to have the subsidy so that it'll actually boost crop prices.
I would just add that I think going back to biodiesel for a second, the fact that they're going to large scale production with soy, that gives more political incentive to Congress to push this through because, soy farmers have really been hurt by the tariffs as well. It's still a terrible idea. It's still throwing money at a product that the market hasn't said it wants. We have said over and over again that, yes, the president's tariffs are costing money to a lot of people who are being affected by them. But the response isn't to just throw more money at them. It's to make smarter decisions in a more methodical way. Just as a reminder, if you have questions, you can email them to president@taxpayer.net, and we'll try to answer them. We have a couple that we will address in the next section, and we want to move on to talking about two, connected issues that people don't always think about together, but they really are very related. Infrastructure spending and disaster spending. They relate to each other for a variety of reasons. If our infrastructure isn't up to date, we have the potential of more expensive harm in disasters. We'll always pass some kind of disaster spending bill because we're compassionate people and because people hate to see, for good reason, hate to see people in their flooded houses or whatever it may be. But first, since, in Washington, we always say it's always infrastructure week somewhere. So last week was infrastructure week again. And so let's talk about kind of how we want Congress and the president to approach any infrastructure investments they make and what's happening. Steve?
Well, so last week, actually, you could argue to some extent it made sense to have it at infrastructure week. But as you said, during this administration, it seems like it keeps on coming up because the president had the Democratic leadership of the House and the Senate up the White House to talk about infrastructure and basically threw out a $2 trillion number. That's all we have is really a number, which then got a lot of members of the president's party up in arms in Congress about worrying about how to pay for that or whether to pay for that. Yet we're still just, there is no there. There is no substance. I like what DJ Gribben, who until recently was the Trump administration's infrastructure policy person, saying that to the Washington Post, I find it unusual how much the conversation is, how much are we going to spend instead of what are we going to accomplish? And I think that it's really important that you figure out how we want to, what we want to accomplish with any infrastructure investment. There's wide agreement, but then not on the actual details. And so when we've done our analysis, we've been talking about, you need to fix it first, deal with the repair issues. That stop doing what doesn't work, and so in many cases there we have deadbeat dams or unneeded roadways. We need to prioritize our spending, and that's something that is not really happening hardly at all. And so that's one thing, and nobody has really laid out a plan, and certainly not a plan to pay for it or even to pay for part of it. And so we'll see exactly how this develops, but it's something that we're going to pay attention to. Then moving into the other part of the discussion, it was the disasters. And so there is...
I'm going to stop you before you go on to disasters and just say a couple things about infrastructure. One question that we got before the call was, if you're going to spend $2 trillion on infrastructure, doesn't that mean that you have to reduce spending elsewhere? And, one of our core principles is that government needs to really prioritize its spending across the board. It's particularly true in the context of infrastructure. But the question of kind of how we pay for this is, it's a complicated question like it is for everyone else. Absolutely, we need to have some offsets that, and there's plenty of things we can cut spending on, and you could just comb through our website to find a few examples. But it also means that we have to kind of identify our revenue needs and say, if we can't figure out a way to cut things, then we have to figure out a way to get more money, because we are fortunate that we have low interest rates now. Seems unlikely we'll have them forever. And the more we deficit finance everything we do, the more we're saddling our kids with incredible debt payments on to disaster.
Sure. So on disaster, there was the president basically put the brakes on a proposal back a few weeks ago that would provide about $17 billion in total disaster funding. He was arguing against some of the assistance to Puerto Rico. That seems like it has been resolved and that there is this assistance for Puerto Rico. The president's been throwing around a very odd number, $91 billion, saying that that's how much has been spent in Puerto Rico. As we talked with PolitiFact.org and fact check PolitiFact and with factcheck.org and the Washington Post fact checker, that's not a real number. That is actually includes a whole tens of billions of dollars of projected spending that would happen under FEMA over the next several decades under the Stafford Act, which governs disaster funding. So anyway, it's something that we haven't seen the actual bill, but we also anticipate that there is going to be some funding in there that's going to try to bail out agriculture. It's something that we've written about separately. And then also, you know, there's flooding going on right now in the Midwest, and that's something that is likely to continue, and we're looking at more and more rain. And so you had major flooding in Davenport, Iowa, just recently. And so these are all things that are kind of coming up. And then I would just flag too that hurricane season is right around the corner, and that's something that then always gets some Congress worked up as well.
One thing I just want to kind of make a note of is that members of Congress are always concerned about how to pay for priorities that they don't share. That's kind of a universal truth. But disaster bills are, you know, a set of bills that often can get through without anybody really arguing that they're not paid for, which makes the kind of what happens in those bills more important to the overall picture of infrastructure and our kind of long-term fiscal health than the idea of providing assistance for people who have suffered from a natural disaster. And there's a couple different threads of that. One is kind of the strings that we put on our disaster spending are, you know, create a bunch of perverse incentives, and I'll let Steve talk about that. And the other is, this is a bill that's going to get through. It doesn't have to be paid for, so things get glommed onto it. Steve, you want to talk a little bit about the general policies under the Stafford Act and the kind of problems with how we give money to communities that have suffered a big natural disaster?
Well, we provide assistance under the Stafford Act. I mean, it's basically a state says this disaster has overwhelmed our ability to respond, ask the president to declare a national disaster. Then the president declares that opens up funding from the Disaster Relief Fund, which is a revolving fund administered by FEMA. Then what often happens is we get this legislation that also follows on that adds more money. And so you'd have programs like, for instance, out of HUD called the Community Development Block Grant. We have a regular program annually in that. But then they would create a disaster recovery one that isn't statutory authorized, is treated differently by different administrations. There's a huge amount of money that's gone into this. You know, we're talking about $30 billion after Harvey, Irma, and Maria. And so it's something that it becomes a huge cash cow for some of these communities. And I'm not saying that they don't need to have assistance, but some of it is we need to make sure that the communities, the counties, the states have skin in the game, and it's not just all coming from federal subsidies, because when they need to make the investments up front that then reduce that risk going forward. And every dollar we spend on disaster recovery should pre-spawn to future disasters, because we already know this place is vulnerable. We know that some of these issues are there. You have cases of where counties and towns have made zoning decisions that have put people more at risk. And so it's a very convoluted affair. And then the last thing I'd flag is that these the people who are impacted, the politicians that have the constituents, they want to strike where the iron's hot. They argue for as much cash as they can possibly get. But we're still paying out issues regarding Sandy, which is in 2012. There's even some money that's still out there dealing with Katrina as of a couple of years ago, and that was 2005. So clearly we could meet this money out over time and actually have better investments and have more confidence in our investments.
Well, and a couple things. I mean, obviously, if you think about what it takes to respond to a natural disaster, and hopefully, you know, you haven't lived through a terrible natural disaster, but, you know, it's a series of difficult decisions that should be informed. There's a couple of immediate expenses that are maybe gigantic and terrible, but then how do you rebuild as a community isn't something that you should decide in 2 months. The other thing I would say is that, you know, there have been studies that say that for every dollar you spend on, and Steve will correct me if I'm totally wrong, but for every dollar you spend on pre-disaster mitigation, you save $6 in disaster response. So that's just thinking about, you know, my father-in-law grew up on the Jersey Shore, and, you know, Sandy, it took a walloping Sandy. If for the communities that had done a little more preparation with the way they prepared their beaches and had required their homes to be more elevated, you know, they had less harm. The other thing I want to talk about is kind of in the context of disaster spending. Steve talked a little bit about the community development block grant, but also for the Army Corps of Engineers, which has a variety of missions, but one of which is flood control and response. You know, a huge, huge, huge percent of their budget is coming through disaster funding. It doesn't have the priorities that it has in the regularly authorized spending. Steve, you want to say a little more?
Sure. Well, the documentation, and this is as of a couple years ago, and I'm sure with the huge amount of cash that they got post-Harvey, that basically they doubled their regular budget through emergency supplemental spending. So essentially, as much as money they got in the regular budget, they got that same amount or more, I would argue now in the most recent years, in emergency supplemental spending. And so some of the issues there is about capacity, but then also it's about, well, now we're really picking a certain region that is benefiting disproportionately through the Army Corps of Engineers. And also, you know, are we going to be building the right projects? And so in a lot of cases, you know, we're seeing the same sort of thing rebuilt rather than actually taking a step back. They're a construction agency, so the idea of doing non-structural measures are generally not as attractive to them. And so these are tensions that exist. And then even the Corps sometimes gets caught in the middle. So for instance, in some of the agricultural flooding that happened just recently in the Midwest, the Corps operates the Missouri River. They have a master manual that deals with how much is done for the environment. They maintain it for navigation. And so there was argument that from some of these communities that the way they managed the river, it actually increased the flooding. Now, I think that what has come out has been this would have flooded no matter how the Corps was operating the river. But nevertheless, it shows some of these tensions that have occurred.
Yeah, I think the other thing, I mean, we've said this a lot, and you can look around at the materials we've written on disaster response on our website, but, you know, we basically, the easiest thing to get federal support for is something that you know failed, and that's just backwards. We just need to change the incentives for disaster response and, you know, provide incentives for communities to do thoughtful plans about what they'll do. I also want to just add a clarification to what Steve said when, you know, he says, we all understand what it means when the Army Corps is a construction agency and they like to build things. What non-structural things are in the context of flood control are like building up wetlands, not necessarily replacing every building that got destroyed, but instead increasing the absorptive capacity so that the land can take in more water and it doesn't just flood on the paved surfaces.
Or buyouts of right. You know, strategic buyouts in areas where then you're reducing the impact or setting back levees. There's a variety of things that you can do that to try to reduce the impact of future disasters, because we know that if it already happened to this one area, it can happen again.
Right. So in terms of other questions, I just want to make sure that we're covering what I know that's come in. I think, you know, we've had a couple different questions on prioritization, which I think we've tried to address. You know, there are a lot of, you know, infrastructure's in some ways one of the easier areas to talk about prioritization. Doesn't mean it's easier to make Congress do it, but it applies to the whole government. We just need to be able to know what's the most important thing for us to spend money on. How are we going to pay for it? What's the most important, you know, what's the best way for the economy to get revenue? And all of those different questions about how we prioritize are kind of at the root of everything we do at Taxpayers. Steve, do you want to address that one other question we got?
Well, there was a question that we got about, actually they're kind of related about infrastructure investments. And one was talking about locks, particularly a lock in the Industrial Canal, which is in New Orleans, which is actually where one of the levees failed during Katrina that inundated the lower Ninth Ward. And then another about investments, say, in as far as constructing land or building onto Manhattan. These are issues that you know we have to think about as far as what makes the most sense in as far as an investment. And some of it is about removing, you know, what doesn't work or not making things worse and making a strategic investment. And so those are all challenges that need to be addressed as you go forward in any kind of infrastructure decision. And really, it all does come back down towards prioritization. Even if they were able to get $2 trillion, which is a big lift, that still would be, there would be oversubscribed demands from people wanting to have a variety of infrastructure, everything from broadband internet to new port deepenings to aviation improvements to you know, schools, you name it. There's been a whole push, which is not really even a federal responsibility. So those are all things that, you know, you're going to have to look at and have to figure out a way to prioritize.
You know, one thing I think about, Steve and Autumn have heard me repeat this a million times, so they can stop listening for a minute. But I was on a panel several years ago about infrastructure and how to get a highway bill through and how to get significant investments in repairing the roads and the bridges across the country. And there were two congressional staff there, and you know, all the academics in the crowd said, obviously the thing to do is raise the gas tax. That's exactly what we should need to do. And you know, both congressional staffers said, there is a constant and growing appetite for more road projects, for more construction, for more infrastructure, and zero tolerance for increasing revenue through the gas tax. So there we are, and here we are again. But Steve.
Well, there was a question about the GAIN Act and Generating American Income and Infrastructure Now Act that has some broad support as where it would sell off agriculture department loans that would that are troubled and help fund infrastructure. The thing is that still we're talking about a small, minute percentage. Even if that would work, and we'd have to look a little bit more at it to be more thorough on this, it would still generate only a small fraction of the revenue that would be needed to offset any major infrastructure package.
It's definitely not $2 trillion.
Right.
So we're coming up on the end of our half hour. I want to thank everybody for joining us again. Even if you can still send questions to president@taxpayer.net. We will, you know, we try to do this the first Monday of every month. Next month, mark your calendar for 1 o'clock Eastern time on June 3rd. I'm Ryan Alexander. Thank you, Autumn Hanna and Steve Ellis. And we'll talk to you next month.
You've been listening to Common Sense Conversations, a production of Taxpayers for Common Sense. To find out more about us, go to www.taxpayer.net.